Hello, welcome to Outside In. My name's John Burns, and this is my podcast for people who like to be in the outdoors. And right now, sometimes we can and sometimes we can't. But my interview today is with a man. I think you've got to describe him as an adventurer. He's done some incredible hikes in the Himalayas. He's cycled from Cambridge to Greece. And when I was talking to him about this, he almost forgot to mention he'd rode the Atlantic. So as you can see, this is a very special guy. And also, I have to say, this is quite unusual for me in that my guest today is actually, as we speak, is on a great one of his latest expedition, I think you'd have to call it, his latest adventure, which is to walk around the coast of Britain. And he's actually doing that right now. Well, he's not actually walking as we speak, if you know what I mean, but he's right in the middle of that expedition right now. And he's raising funds doing that for children in need. So I really wanted to talk. It sounded like a great thing to do, and I wanted to talk to him about his experiences. So I'm very pleased to have my guest today, who is Chris Howard. How are you, Chris?
Hi, John. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. So how are your feet at the moment then?
Feet are pretty good. They're well adapted to the walk now. I've gone a fair few miles on them, and no blisters as such. My boots are pretty good. I'm taking good care of them. So yeah, all good on the feet.
Oh well, that's always good on a long distance walk, isn't it? Now tell me, you've done an awful lot of things, and what is it attracts you to these sort of adventures? Why did you do it in short? You know,
yeah, good question. It's not until I speak to someone like you and I sort of list off the things that I've done that I really understand just how much I've done. But I suppose initially I wanted to learn about the world and my place in it. And I started discovering more about myself and other people and other cultures by traveling and things I was doing. But I suppose also from an endurance perspective, I'm not the world's greatest athlete, but I've always been in sport. I've always been pushing myself or being pushed by coaches and other people. And I realized that actually the only way I could push myself beyond barriers and boundaries was to give myself challenges that other people couldn't conceive of doing. So I think from an endurance perspective, physically and mentally, that's what keeps me going and pushing them.
And before you started this walk, then, what was your biggest physical challenge, would you say?
The biggest physical challenge I've ever done is most likely rowing the Atlantic, because it's just a solid, no rest kind of, you've got to get across an ocean, you know, so it's 105 days of just solid rowing in 2 hours.
Was that on your own, can I ask you? Did you do that solo or was there somebody else with you?
I did it with my best friend, Tom, and we're still best friends.
Well, yeah, that was going to be my next question. 105 days in a boat sort of puts a bit of a test on a relationship, I would have thought.
It does. You know what? We never actually argued. We had really good mechanisms in place, good procedures. We checked in with each other properly every day. We got to a point where we said, right, we can't go on the way we're going on, because it actually can be quite isolating, even though there's two of you on the boat.
Yes.
You never see each other because you row in 2 hour shifts, so apart from the changeover you don't speak or see each other, because you just try and sleep the other 2 hours or eat. So we every day we would check in and we would actually eat together, and we would stop for an hour and just check in with each other. And that was good for us in terms of our mental health, but it also gave us a chance to look over each other physically and figure out if there was anything wrong. At one point we had serious skin infections and they needed a dress. So yeah, it was important that we did that.
Right. And well, what would you say? Were there any sort of scary moments, or was the whole thing quite scary?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is scary. But again, I think that's another reason to attempt it. You know, it's only by putting yourself in positions of discomfort and fear that you really learn who you are and start to understand what you're capable of. We were stalked by sharks, adopted by pods of dolphins and whales.
Oh, wow.
Our water maker broke completely. We lost electronics, our battery compartments flooded, we capsized. There's all sorts of things that went wrong. If you can imagine a boat trip where everything that could go wrong at sea went wrong, we were that example. For example, we planned to cross in between 60 and 80 days, and it ended up being 105 days. Wow. So at the end, we were completely malnourished. I think I'd lost just under 5 stone in total.
Bloody hell. Okay.
To ration our food, obviously, and ration the water supplies because our water maker broke. So we were on a water ban for about 16, 17 days or something like that, where we'd gone from drinking 7 or 8 liters of water a day, often with isotonic replacement powders and things like that, and electrolytes in 40 odd degree heat on the equator and rowing 12 hours a day, to then only having a liter of water a day each with no isotonic electrolyte replacements. And that liter was allocated for cooking, cleaning, and washing. So that became incredibly difficult.
That's a pretty serious situation. I mean, you've not really emphasized it, but that's a pretty serious situation to be in, really, isn't it?
It got so dire that at one point we'd hit a bit of a doldrum, which is where there's no current, mm-hmm. no wind, nothing, and we were actually only making about a third of a mile every hour. It became pointless to row.
Right.
So we took the opportunity to do some maintenance and try and figure out what we could do. I'd stripped down the water maker and put it back together, cleaned all the filters, still nothing. But there again, our electrics weren't working either. So we couldn't be sure we'd get it back online. But what we knew we had to do was get the water out of the battery compartment, get the batteries online again if we could. But because the water was in there was actually a leak we'd found, but we'd managed to scoop out a lot of the water, and an American cargo ship passing actually contacted us via VHF radio and said, "Are you all right? Blah, blah, blah." To which we responded, "We're not actually all right. We've got this problem. Is there any way you can help?" So they were scheduled to do a maintenance stop as well. And the captain there, Captain Besh, he came over the radio and said, "Look, we can try and help you, but given your situation being as dire as it is, it's my recommendation that you actually abandon ship and we bring you on board and take you back to Louisiana and you can fly home safe to your family." Sadly, the response that he got from us was one of a polite decline, because for Tom and I, it had never been an option to give up. And certainly were up at that point. So he rigged up a pulley line with some of the engineers to our boat, which was one of the most dangerous things I've ever done, actually, because you've got a huge, great big tanker, you know, 200 meters long or whatever, 200 tons plus whatever it is, and this tiny little ocean rowing boat off the back of it just being pulled towards it by this pulley system.
Oh my God.
it took everything we had just to stop the pitch and roll of their boat dragging us towards it. But they sent over a load of food supplies, even fresh cookies that were baked on board that day. They were still warm when they got there. It was amazing. Wow. but the important thing is that they sent over some soap. So that made it easier for Tom and I over the next few days. They sent over some epoxy resin and a hot reaction kit, which meant we could fix our leak. They sort of stuck around the area to see if we could do it, and they sort of guided us through it. Now, I had to get my head into this tiny hatch hole with a headlamp so that I could see what was going on in there. And I was at this funny angle whilst Tom was mixing up this stuff and passing it through. And eventually we managed to clog the hole enough and it welded and dried that the leak stopped completely. And after a few days, the batteries started to generate charge again, which means our GPS came back online. Our water maker didn't come back online straight away, but we now had fresh water from this American ship. Uh-huh. And that lasted over 3 or 4 days. After that, we kept checking the satellite phone. We kept charging everything, kept running routine checks, just making it a disciplined thing to just do those checks every hour. About 10 days later, all our lights in the boat came back on. The GPS flashed up. Our satellite phone was charged enough and came back online. We managed to get a weather report and messages to our families. But at that point, we could only get messages out. We couldn't call. We only had a text function.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end of that point, our water maker just kicked into life, and we made as much water as we possibly could and hydrated as much as we could. But one of the scary things about that is not having electrics on a boat at night means nobody can see you.
Oh, right. So yeah.
Whilst one of us was rowing, one of us was on, the other one was on deck with a headlamp or a torch intermittently flashing to make sure that if there was anything out there, they might see the light.
Right. Although the chances of a big tanker seeing you in a very small boat in a very large ocean is fairly dodgy. So anyway, that in itself, to be honest, if I'd rowed the Atlantic, that'd be it. I'd go home, sit and watch the TV for the rest of my life. But obviously, that's not the sort of person you are. And tell us about what you're doing right now, the challenge you're on right now.
Yeah, so I'm currently walking 11,000 miles around the coast of mainland Britain. I started in Norfolk and headed south. So I've done all of that southeast coast, all mm-hmm. of the south coast, then up the north coast of Cornwall, into Devon and Somerset, up to Chepstow, all the way around the Welsh coast path, northwest of England, and now into Scotland. I'm just outside Glasgow. I've been walking for 250 days today, and I cover a minimum of a marathon distance a day and often up to 30 miles a day. I did a challenge day in honor of 40 years of Pudsey for children in need, and I covered 40 miles in that day, which actually ended up being 44.
Okay.
I never really want to do that again if I can help it. I have everything I need in my backpack, and I carry everything. I sleep in my tent or my bivvy bag. I kind of rely on the kindness of strangers as well to give me food donations here and there. I very rarely stay indoors, but today I have a room. I've booked a room in a hotel, partly because I hadn't had a wash for 4 weeks, and partly right. because we were going to have this chat and I needed to charge everything up and get a good Wi-Fi connection.
I'm very honored that you did that. That's great. And what's it been like? I mean I realize that, you know, you're probably relying on the assistance of other folk to keep you going with food and stuff at times. What's that been like during the pandemic then?
It's been really tough. You know, I didn't just set out with a challenge to walk around the coast, did I? I set out with a challenge to walk around the coast, which is difficult enough, but I set out time, which has never happened in history. So it's been very strange. People have been incredibly kind, especially in Wales, Cornwall, and most of England. I haven't experienced a lot of kindness in Scotland yet, but that's largely because I haven't been here very long. And also, media here are just starting to pick up on what I'm doing.
Right.
But also, the numbers for coronavirus in Scotland are still on the rise. And I think there's a kind of general feeling that it's still very difficult here. And as much as I'm isolated almost all of the time, I think there's probably a lot of people that think I shouldn't be here. Tourists as well, you know. But saying that, the people that I have met, and I say that, you know, I don't meet a lot of people. I can go three, four weeks. And then suddenly I'll meet two or three people in a town and they want to feed me and help me. And they've been lovely. So it's a strange time all round.
It is. I mean, I do understand what you're saying. Obviously, I live in Scotland and it has, there is an issue without a doubt right now. About particularly with people coming from out with the Highlands, for example, into remote communities where the rate of the virus has been pretty low in a lot of small remote communities. But obviously there's this sort of catch 22 situation with communities up here really at the moment, because a lot of these small communities rely on tourism. And yet the one thing that they're worried about is you know, people coming in from different places. But you're saying did you say you were just about north of Glasgow? Is that at the moment? Is that right?
I'm just before Glasgow.
Just before Glasgow. Okay.
I should be over the Erskine Bridge today.
All right. So you're really just getting into the remoter parts of the Highlands right now, aren't you?
Yeah, a friend of mine said, "Oh, you haven't really hit Scotland yet because you haven't passed the Erskine Bridge. Once you get through the Erskine Bridge, that's when Scotland."
Well, in all fairness, I think there are some fairly remote places in Dumfries and Galloway. I think that's true.
That's very true. And all of the Solway View, and actually the place I felt most isolated was on the Mull of Galloway.
Yeah.
It's an amazing peninsula to walk around. But until you kind of get back to Stranraer, you feel like you're completely out of civilization. It's
Yes.
amazing.
I mean, that peninsulas like that. How can I put it? They're like islands that are joined to the mainland, really. They're that remote, aren't they?
That affects the way people are, I think, that the people that live on the island or that those peninsulas are different to the people on the mainland.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. So when you ch how do you choose your route? Because obviously, it's almost, I should imagine, it's pretty much close to physically impossible to walk along the actual coast all the way. Do you try and link together footpaths, or how do you do it?
Yeah, so exactly that. I try and link together footpaths. If I can be on the beach, then I'm on the beach. There are areas where I've sort of done more coast steering than walking, and I
Yeah.
had to scramble rocks and things like that. If there are no alternative routes to being on the beach, there is no path, for example, and it's not safe, then I take the closest adjacent road to the coast. Dumfries and Galloway is a pretty good example of that. There are areas where you just can't get to the beach, and there's some private owned beaches by estates there as well.
Oh, right.
You end up walking along the A75, which you're probably familiar with that road, and it's not a very pleasant road to walk on.
No, that's right. That's right. You should buy, and obviously you're moving now up into you've got a lot of pretty rugged country ahead of you now, and you'll be walking up to, so some of the areas that I know quite well are sort of up in Sutherland and the wilder places like Cape Wrath and the coastline to the north of there, which is well, I suppose the truth of it is that a lot of it is, if you call Sutherland a trackless waste, I think you might insult a few people. But there are certainly a lot of places where there are no paths whatsoever. So that
Sure.
might slow you down a bit. I don't know.
I think it will. I mean, I clocked, and it last week, it just being on the Mull of Galloway, I clocked my route for the end of week update, and did my map check and stuff like that, and to see my distance. And I think I'd done something like 109 miles, and I was being really hard on myself, thinking, "This is ridiculous. You've done nothing this week." And then really, the elevation was something like 9,000 meters ascent and descent all in the same week. So I really didn't have to be as hard on myself.
Well, coastal walking can be like that, can't it? You can be it's a bit like I suppose walking up and along a roller coaster track in some ways. You don't go very far, but you go up and down a hell of a lot.
Should be making 4 and a half miles an hour, and then suddenly you're down to less than a mile an hour. That's how it is.
That's right. It can be like that. And one of the things about coastal walking I've noticed is that you can see the weather coming often from some considerable distance away sometimes. Have you found that?
That can be both a good thing and a bad thing, as you
Absolutely, absolutely.
is fascinating. People think of navigation as just looking at a map or an app on your phone, but actually, there's a lot of natural navigation you can do using the clouds and the weather systems, and it can be very helpful to anticipate those things in advance, especially when you're on a boat in the Atlantic, for example. But the skills I've learned about meteorology there have come into application here as well. Because it means I can get to shelter quicker. It means I can, get out of dodge nice and quickly, and therefore have a more comfortable night.
Right. So you obviously, I mean, so the experiences that you've had really on the ocean have probably helped you on the coastal path. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I would definitely think that in terms of practicality, and in terms of theory as well, and looking at different things and understanding not just what I'm capable of, but what's happening around me in terms of the environment.
And so how long do you think you've got to go before you finish this then? Because you've got to come, presumably you're walking all the way around the coast and back to Norfolk, is that right?
That's right, yeah. There are a couple of islands thrown into the mix as well. Skye, for example, is connected by road bridge, and Skye's quite big, so I will be doing...
Okay, sorry, go on.
My biggest worry will be Noidart, to be honest, but I'm sort of looking that up at the moment. I always planned to finish by the end of this year. However, I feel like I might be being slightly optimistic because Scotland is so big.
It's a big place, Scotland. As you say, Noidart, you know, you've got, it's been known to rain in Noidart now and again. And some of the places, you obviously river crossings can be an issue, as you know.
Yeah. I have waded a few of the rivers, but there are some rivers coming up that I know they're not wadable. You know, you'd be taking your life in your hands. So you just have to assess and see what the best course of action is. I generally won't be taking any of the connecting ferries. Somebody suggested it would be easier for me to island hop rather than stick to the actual coast.
Right.
However, that isn't really the challenge that I set myself. I set the challenge of walking the coast, and that's what I intend to do.
Right. So, I mean, you have to have, to do something like that, like, you know, some of the challenges that you've done, or in fact, all of them really, you have to have a pretty strong level of determination about you. Where do you think that comes from?
That's very interesting. I don't know. I think, you know, I've grown up competing in a lot of sport. I was a rugby player for a long time, and then with the rowing. And I only discovered running as a hobby much, much later in life, because that's something you can compete with yourself with. It's not something to measure up to somebody else. I think it's just, I have this sort of innate fear as a man of never achieving anything really tangible and useful to myself. I think you can learn everything you want from going to school and university and reading books, but you can't learn anything about yourself. The only person that can teach you that is you. Mm-hmm. And the outdoor great way of exposing what's under there and showing you your true metal.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that the certainly I used to do a lot of climbing when I was younger, and some long distance walking and things like that. The challenges really teach you more about yourself and the landscape. There's no doubt about that. I think so. Now, tell us, obviously you're doing this for BBC Children in Need. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So I decided I wanted to do something for children that were potentially being forgotten about during that initial phase of lockdown and coronavirus. I specifically wanted to do something with children because I was looking at my own children during that time, and they were so lucky to have my wife and I around to love them and care for them and, you know, play with them and do all sorts of things. And they were lucky to have each other as well.
Yeah.
And there were lots of children out there that didn't have that, but also lots of children out there who it was worse for going back to a family situation or a home rather than being in school. And I couldn't stop thinking about children being forgotten about and in less advantaged positions and particularly in abusive homes and backgrounds. So there was no specific coronavirus children's charity, obviously. There wouldn't be, because this has never happened before.
Yes.
So I looked up Children in Need, and I knew that Children in Need reached a lot of other organizations, and they help fund those organizations. And the thing on their website which struck out immediately to me was they reach children in every corner of the UK. That was really important, because that's exactly what my journey is doing, reaching every corner of the UK. But not only that, I was amazed by, there's a lot of sort of myths around them as a charity and these big salaries and stuff, but actually if you look into it, 96 pence of every pound goes directly to supporting a child. That's incredible for an organization
to be able to say that.
So I was really keen to work with them. I spoke to them on the phone. They were very positive straight away. They've been very helpful. And I should be clear as well, a lot of people think that my journey is funded by Children in Need. That's not how it works.
Right.
I self-fund this. They don't even pay for a t-shirt for me. I had to print my own t-shirt. So that again shows you that their money is going to the right place, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
About as well, it's not about profile raising for me in any way. It's about raising as much money as I can for them to help children. And I'm up to, my initial target was £10,000, and I broke that pretty quickly, so I decided to double it, and I got to £20,000 fairly quickly after that.
That's amazing. It really is something, isn't it?
Yeah, so I decided to double that again in honor of Pudsey's 40th anniversary. So I've doubled it to 40. And I've not quite reached that. I'm actually just reaching £25,000 now, which is still
right.
A long way to go.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, that's a really worthwhile thing. And you're quite right. I think that you know, everybody has suffered, I guess, to some degree, some people more than others. And, you know, through the pandemic, it's been, for all of us, I think it's been one of the most difficult things we face in our lives. And I think that it's been particularly hard for children and young people. So it's really important, I think, that the cause that you're walking for and in many ways you're fighting for right now is very important. So what I'll do is, anyone listening to this, I'm going to be putting a link to the Just Giving site, so you can donate to Chris's walk and to Children in Need on the actual podcast site, and there'll be a link for that. So please do that if you listen to this podcast, you've enjoyed it, even if you haven't enjoyed it, to be quite honest. It's a very worthwhile thing to do. Give us a little donation, that'd be fantastic, and to help, you know, Chris on his way, that'd be great. I was thinking, Chris, you know, you're still a fair old way to go. Well, I'd be great to catch up with you again. And I was thinking that a great place to do that might be Cape Wrath, because you'll be there's a wee cafe and a little bunkhouse there, and it's an outpost I think, to be quite honest, I've been to Cape Wrath quite a few times. Calling it an outpost of civilization is stretching it a bit, but there's electricity there anyway, and it is quite a spectacular place. So I don't know, would you fancy that? Do you think we could check in again when you get to Cape Wrath?
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds good. I'm not entirely sure when that'll be, but yeah, I'll keep.
No,
posted.
I mean, that's fine. It you know, it happens when it happens, really. I think that would be really good.
I'm more than happy to do that. I just want to very quickly as well say thank you to a couple of people that I met this week. If you
go
don't
for
mind.
It, yeah, absolutely.
I met a family, and I've never experienced this before, but their little girl bought me some sweets, and they are Iron Brew jelly babies. Never had them before, so I'm really excited about them. And I met a family, Jules and Chris Kelly, and their son, who was really, really happy to talk to me about Harry Potter. Really lovely lad. Very grateful, because I've just started reading the first Harry Potter book, and so has my oldest twin daughter. And so I'm reading it chapter by chapter with her on and off via FaceTime, which is amazing.
That sounds fantastic. It's amazing that you're able to do that. And I have to say that if you're eating Iron Brew jelly babies, then you actually definitely have made it to Scotland, you know. Anyway, listen, it's been fantastic talking to you. I just to say again, I really hope, folks, you've listened to this and you feel like giving a few quid. That would be fantastic. And I'll talk to you again in Cape Wrath.
Brilliant. Okay, thanks, John.
Thanks very much, Chris. That was great. Enjoy talking to you. Take care. And I hope all the best for the rest of your walk.